It's 8:01, Monday, August 9th, and you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM. Good morning and welcome to the Master Gardener Hour, the shortest hour in radio. Good morning. This is John Duke. I'll be your host until 9 o'clock. My guest today is Jim Hansel, highly educated and enthusiastic plantsman, to talk about ornamental grasses and lots of other interesting things going on in the garden. Amy Duke, my gardening partner, is here with me too. And we also have my friend, Master Gardener Bibby Terry, to help out in the studio and jump in with the conversation. WAIF FM, as a community radio station, serves only to open its airwaves to responsible, divergent points of view. The opinions expressed during the Master Gardener Hour do not reflect the views of WAIF, its staff, or Board of Trustees. The opinions expressed reflect my own views or the views of my guests, which may change at any moment. It's 8:03, and you're listening to WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM, the real stepchild radio, what radio is meant to be. My theme music for the show is Coconuts on the CD Nature's Bounty by Mystical Moods. If you have any comments or suggestions, we invite you to write or call us at the station. Send your letters to WAIF FM, 1434 East McMillan Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45206, or call us at 513-749-1444. Well, good morning, Jim.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Good morning, Bibby. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, John.
It's another beautiful day in Cincinnati. Jim, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here.
I think let's get started by telling folks a little bit about yourself, what you've done, where you are, what you like.
Sure. I've been in the field of horticulture now. I think this is about my 15th year. I have a degree in horticulture from Cincinnati State Technical College. Well, when I was there, it was just Cincinnati Technical College. I have another degree from Xavier, and this December I'll finish my master's degree in plant ecology from Miami University. So I'm real excited to go beyond that. Professionally, career-wise, I spent some time at the Cincinnati Zoo Botanic Garden, worked in the private industry, was director of horticulture at the Civic Garden Center for 5 years, and now I manage and run Ohio River Grass, a nursery specializing in ornamental grasses. So that's a quick rundown of what I've done.
Yeah, well, I guess I met you when you were at the Civic Garden Center.
Yeah, I think we
met years ago.
We met probably 7 years ago now.
Yeah, something like that.
I met you early on.
Yeah, yeah. And I know you're happy down there at Ohio River Grass.
I'm having a great time. We've got this is the time of the year when our garden looks the best.
Yeah.
We've got about an acre and a half display garden, and the grasses are finally starting to bloom. And we've had lots of rain this year. Everything's looking great.
That's good.
Yep.
Yeah. Why don't you tell folks about Ohio River Grass, where you're located and what you do and all that?
We're located off of Winter Street, which is right off of Eastern Avenue near the Precinct Restaurant. We are kind of a unique place in that we have we specialize in one type of plant. You know, we just carry ornamental grasses.
You don't carry anything else?
We don't. We just do the grasses. We feel that we want to know and learn everything we can about ornamental grasses, so that's what we stay focused on. We do have a nice display garden that's free and open to the public. So anytime anybody wants to come and just walk through the garden, they're more than welcome to do that. I'm very excited to tell you that we just finished, and we're finishing up this week, labeling the garden. So if you've been to the garden, you can now come down and actually know what you're looking at, which is a real plus.
Yeah.
We also have a contemporary art show opening on August 21st. And that will run through the end of September, but the pieces will be in the garden on into next spring. So we're very excited to have an Art in the Garden show. Got some really, really nice pieces of art going in.
Mm-hmm.
So we're excited about that.
Well, that's great. I had been down there for, I don't know, a number of years ago when Stuart Fink was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you folks have certainly made a lot of improvements.
Yeah, Stuart got everything started for us. He certainly laid the foundation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we've just built upon what he started.
It's always been a real interesting place.
It has. It's, you know, Stuart always says that that place always brings unique people.
Yeah.
And it really does. We've got some of the best people in the city that come down and visit us and spend time there. So
yeah. Tell us about I've always wondered kind of what the story is of those big boulders. You got some huge boulders down there.
It depends on who you talk to, but I've been told that those big rocks are actually foundations and curbs from buildings and streets from downtown. And they were brought there and stored there. And, you know, we appropriated them the way we did to kind of order the space a little bit better. And that's where they all came from. They're huge limestone pieces. They probably weigh 2-3 tons a piece.
Yeah, so
we had to use a really large machine to put those things in place.
I thought maybe somebody was starting to build a pyramid or something.
That's
the kind of place you see the old Egyptians used to haul around.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. But what's nice, too, about the garden is there's still quite a few pieces of Stuart's art. And that is a permanent part of our garden. So it's nice to come down and see, you know, his original vision and how that material would work with grasses, because, you know, his media at that time was cast concrete, and that stuff is very static.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, you plant dynamic grasses around it, and it's a nice juxtaposition. So it's a great place to get ideas.
It's a good combination, the heavy stone and the grass. Yeah.
It is, and it's a great place just to come get some ideas. You know, I know a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of people that would like to incorporate art into their garden, but they're not really sure how to do it. And I think seeing examples like down at Ohio River Grass, you can see that and how to do that.
Okay. Well, now, I've got some questions about grass.
All right.
And I'm sure you can straighten me out.
Well, if I can, I'll just make it up. How's that sound?
Okay, that's good. That's good. There are true grasses, whatever that is, and then there are sedges and rushes and sweet flag and things like that that are apparently not true grasses.
Yes.
But they're all monocots, I think.
That is exactly right. They're all monocots. The true grasses, biologically, tend to have hollow stems. They're jointed. I don't know if you've probably, the classic example of a jointed grass would be like Johnson grass. You know how the Johnson grass, where the blade comes out, there's like a joint.
Right.
The joints in true grasses tend to be solid. So what separates the grasses from, say, a sedge or a carex. The sedges tend to have solid stems, whereas the grasses are hollow. And that makes sense biologically because sedges tend to be short-growing plants.
Okay.
Grasses are taller-growing plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the stems are hollow because it allows them to be flexible in the wind.
Okay.
But, if you had a solid stem, you would tend to
break. You would tend to break it,
And then the rushes, which predominantly grow in moist areas, they have completely hollow stems. They have no jointed segments. It's just one blade that comes out from the crown or the growing point of the plant, and it's hollow all the way throughout.
Okay.
So that's really the only delineation between the three. They're all wind pollinated. All grasses are wind pollinated.
Oh, okay.
So wheat and rice and corn and, you know, big blue stem, miscanthus, any of the carexes, the rushes, they're all wind pollinated.
Okay.
So they're, according to some botanists, like Brian Capone, who wrote a book called The Botany for Gardeners.
Uh-huh. Great book.
Yeah, it's a great book. As I was preparing for our talk today, I read through his section on plant reproduction, and he feels that grasses are the most sophisticated plants on the planet because they don't need a pollinator.
Well, that's true, but they are, from a plant evolution standpoint, aren't the monocots later? Didn't they come along after the dicots?
Yes.
Because I had read where grasses only evolved about 12 million years ago.
That's exactly right. That's why many botanists feel that they're a more sophisticated...
Yeah, and they really came on and kind of co-evolved with the grazing animals.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And also climatically, 12 million years ago, it would have been a more dry environment, and grasses are very drought tolerant for the most part. So what they do, I went to a conference this past weekend that was very interesting. It was out at Chaparral Nature Preserve, which is in Adams County.
Oh.
And there's a little, probably a 25-acre prairie there. And the Ohio Department of Natural Research, Ohio Department of Natural Resource specialist, was saying how grasses, native grasses, spend their first 4 or 5 years of their life really putting out a lot of root growth, because that's what gives them their drought tolerance. They have very deep root systems.
Okay. Well, now, what you said native grasses, they're not really native grasses in this part of the country, are there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are.
Because this was all forested areas, I thought. I know the buffalo grass out west is a native grass.
Yeah, partially so. There were areas in Ohio, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of people have the attitude or the idea that the Ohio landscape was pristine, meaning according to the federal government, untrammeled by humans. They have the sentiment that that was the case, where actually some recent anthropological studies have indicated that the Native American peoples that lived in Ohio prior to European settlement had a very sophisticated forest management program. And actually Saturday we talked about this, and there were prairies in Ohio.
Oh, were there? Okay.
Yeah, not much. Okay. You know, maybe 5% of the total area of Ohio would have been considered prairies, but the native grasses that were found there were things like big blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, little blue stem. And then even on down into the smaller grasses, like the Bootaloos or the side oak gramma grasses, those things were native to Ohio.
Okay, so there were a lot of native grasses in this
area.
Okay.
And one of the things that they found out by doing core samples, what they do is they'll take a core of the earth down so many feet, and that from that core they can tease out from the different layers of the core what historically happened during that period of time. And what they found is that the Native Americans had a very sophisticated burn cycle. What they would do is they would go in and burn. They would make a big, maybe a 1 acre or even 1 mile ring of burn. And what they would burn everything in the middle. And what would happen is the vegetation would respond immediately and flush, and it made great grazing grounds.
For the deer.
For deer, for rabbit, and things that they ate.
So they didn't have to go so far to hunt.
Right. So one of the hypotheses that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources were talking about Saturday was that the grasslands were actually maintained by Native American peoples.
Hmm.
Because you're absolutely right. If you leave a lot of these grasslands go, ultimately they will reforest.
Yeah.
But for... you know, who knows how many years it was maintained. There were large tracts of area maintained as prairie.
Down at the museum center, there's a display that shows how the Native Americans stored corn in the ground.
Hmm.
And they dug a pit.
Okay.
And according to this display, they lined it with mold-proof grasses. And I thought,
wow.
Are all grasses mold-proof, or is that something that they learn in particular?
That must have been something that they learned in particular. I've not heard of that. You're talking about Native Americans in this area?
I believe that's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, if that was the case, my guess is they probably would have used things like Indian grass and switchgrass, because when those grasses dry, the reeds tend to get very hard, and they're very resistant to decay.
Okay.
In fact, the Indian grass when we cut our garden back in the spring, we can even feed that through a chipper. It's that hard, and we can feed it through a chipper, and we just top dress our garden with it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
So we just recycle it, put it right back into the ground. So, yeah, I could see that being the case.
Well, this display shows some corn, and it shows this pit several feet deep lined with what looks like a very coarse grass.
Wow.
Almost like bamboo,
Wow.
And I just wondered, they said mold-proof. I suppose that could mean decay-resistant.
Yeah, that's probably what they're referring to. But the other thing that comes to mind, that if you say it looks sort of like bamboo, is we do have a native bamboo-type plant. We don't see too much of it anymore because it's been removed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a plant that grew near waterways.
Oh.
It was a native bamboo called Arundinaria. And you can see some of that if you go down to, like, the Red River Gorge area. There are still pockets of the native bamboo growing down there.
Is that bamboo invasive?
Boy, that's a loaded question. when you start talking about invasive plants, that really, you're asking a geographic question in my mind.
Okay.
If you can get the native Arundinaria to grow, you're doing a pretty good thing. It's a very, it's not like a foreign bamboo or an exotic bamboo that would have super competitive advantage. The native plant, from what I've been told by different people that have tried to grow it, is it's very difficult to propagate. Bamboos, now that we're going to talk a little bit about bamboos, they're grasses as well.
Sure, yeah.
We don't grow any we don't grow any bamboos. There's a gentleman out in Morrow, Ohio, named Jerry Burton, who has a great excellent bamboo collection.
It's been out there.
It's a beautiful place. If you've not been there, it's worth seeing.
Yeah.
But bamboos will flower as well. And some of the bamboo varieties, when they flower, they actually die. That's the end of their life.
Yeah. Well, we had a short, awful experience with bamboo. We were told it was non-invasive, and turns out it was just all over the place. We got it out just in the nick of time. It was spreading like crazy.
Do you recall which
still,
one?
Yeah. It's still there?
Well, there's still some places where I watch for it.
Do you recall what type you had?
No.
Was it a big one or?
No, it wasn't that. Wasn't that tall.
Yeah, the only bamboo that I'm aware of, and I'm sure that there are more, but the one that I'm aware of that is a true clumper is Fergesia.
That doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah, it's a clump-forming bamboo. It's a beautiful plant, but it's the only one that I'm aware of that doesn't spread rampantly by rhizomes. And that's a good point, too. When we talk about clumping grasses versus running grasses, that's something that a lot of people that come to the nursery want to know. It's like, okay, is this thing going to take over my yard? Well, grasses have the potential to be what I would call invasive or aggressive. Let's use the word aggressive. I think invasive that's kind of a charged question or a charged word, but let's use the word aggressive.
Okay.
Grasses can be aggressive in one of two ways. They can either be aggressive by rhizomes, underground stems that run or like runners.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that comes to mind when you say that is, either crabgrass or bamboo. Those things almost fit in the same class at times, I think. And then the other way grasses can be aggressive in your yard are by seed. And there are some grass varieties that do self-sow. For example, I'm thinking of one of the fountain grasses called Meldry. It has a tendency to just proliferate in the garden.
Uh-huh.
I've talked to gardeners that have had that had it planted near. This is where I've seen it the worst. Near, like, streams or moist areas in your garden.
Uh-huh.
That stuff will self-sow, and it just goes everywhere.
Huh.
Go ahead, John.
The clump grasses, the tillers, the individual little grass plants.
Yes.
They get bigger and bigger and bigger.
They do.
But they don't spread like...
That's right.
Like
it's the rate. That the delineation between all grasses spread by rhizomes.
Yeah.
So once you get that out, you realize all the perennial grasses that we do is spread by rhizomes.
What about fescue?
It spreads by rhizomes. It's the rate at which they spread.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so new tillers.
And the distance.
That's exactly
okay,
right.
I get you.
It's a rate issue and a distance issue. But we, you know, for horticultural purposes, it's easier just to say, well, this is a clumping grass, like a miscanthus.
Sure.
You know, that's a clumping grass. You plant that, and, you know, it's going to take 7 or 10 years before the clump's going to get 4 feet around. So
yeah.
It's a very slow grass.
Right.
But you put a bamboo in, or you put in, there's a Penicetum that we grow down at the nursery that we don't sell, but we just have it in our collection, Penicetum incomptum. That's a very fast spreading. I mean, it'll
yeah.
It just
well, this
flops.
Bamboo that we planted, we wanted something that was clump forming, and we were told that's what it was. And Amy didn't like it from the get go.
I should have listened to your wife.
I know. Story of my life.
Well, I'll tell you a story of my life too. You know,
but I decided this spring to go out and dig up one because it wasn't growing very well. You know, it wasn't coming back like I thought it should. And I dug one up to see if the roots were okay on it. And
yeah.
The runners were going 6 feet in every direction.
Did you end up ripping out your whole garden?
Yeah. And so
bamboo's really, it's strange. I grew some black bamboo, Phyllostachys nigra, at my mom's house. My gosh, this is probably 10 years ago. And it sat for 4 years and looked like it did nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, and then about the fifth or sixth year, we started seeing shoots 20 feet from the original clump. So
that's scary.
It must take, I guess what it does, I don't know enough about bamboo to be an authority on it, but it apparently, and I've talked to other people and they've had the same experience, apparently it spends a lot of time laying down an extensive root system. And then something inside of its little biological clock says, okay, I got enough. It's time to grow.
When we pulled this up, there was a lot more plant underground than there was on top.
Yeah, that's been my experience with the plant as well.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about buffalo grass.
Okay.
There's what's called Russian buffalo grass. And then there's buffalo grass that's North American, I guess, native grass. Are they the same?
I don't know enough about the buffalo grasses, quite frankly, to answer that. We grow buffalo grass at the nursery.
Okay.
And my experience with the grass is that it goes dormant during the winter months when it's cold. And then in the summer months, it's green. But what we like about the buffalo grass is we cut it maybe, you know, once every 3 weeks, 4 weeks, even during the active, even this year with all the rain that we've had.
It's a slow grower?
It's a very slow grower.
Okay.
It's a very low grower. We're finding that more and more people are interested in that. You start buffalo grass by seed.
Okay.
You know, all of what we do are in containers. So the easiest way to do buffalo grass is by seed. There are lots of places around the country where you can get buffalo grass.
Yeah.
If you're going to grow some buffalo grass in Cincinnati, what I would recommend doing is finding the northernmost seed source.
Okay.
Because those plants biologically will be a little bit different than the southern seed sources, and they'll be more cold hardy.
Okay.
So the season of interest will last further into the season. Now, the Russian buffalo grass, I would have to assume, has very similar characteristics to the North American type, only because, you know, at one time, if you go back to, like, plate tectonic theory, when Pangea was in existence, that's where those plants were very similar.
Okay.
And then what happened when the continents split, they became isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And when you isolate groups of plants, that's when speciation tends to occur.
Right.
So my guess is they're very similar. I'll check into that because a Russian variety may be better for Cincinnati because it might be more cold hardy. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We had some. Are you familiar with Zubrovka?
No, I don't.
It's a Russian drink.
Oh.
Okay. And
I need to familiarize myself with Zubrovka.
I have some in the car for you.
Excellent.
As a gift to see what you think of it.
Well, I'm celebrating my 10-year anniversary this week.
Okay. So, well, this will help you right along. what you do is you take vodka, just ordinary vodka, and you put some blades of Russian buffalo grass in it. And it flavors the vodka, gives it a slightly green tint, and a really wow flavor.
Wow.
Kind of People describe it as anise.
Oh, okay.
Anise or licorice.
Oh, okay.
Light licorice.
Nice.
But it's a pretty good drink. You drink it very chilled.
I bet.
And we have some. I thought about it when I woke up in the middle of the night, and I said, I bet Jim would like some Zubrovka.
That sounds
and
good.
And we've got a little bit left in a bottle.
Super.
But our buffalo grass that somebody gave us to make Zubrovka with only lasted a couple of years, and it kind of disappeared. So it might not be, at least that one that we got might not be real winter hardy here.
Yeah.
The other buffalo grass might serve the same purpose.
Yeah, it seems to. Our buffalo grass really grows well. The problem that we have with the buffalo grass as a turf substitute is in the early spring when it's dormant. Mm-hmm. Weed seeds tend to get in there.
Yeah.
Now how we deal with that with the weed seeds is we'll go in and just very lightly spot spray the weeds with a little bit of glyphosate or an herb, you know, a non-selective herbicide. Because if the buffalo grass is dormant, you can get away with it. But boy, what a low maintenance lawn substitute, because that's all we do.
Uh-huh.
And then we're done.
It's pretty coarse, isn't it?
The buffalo grass we grow is very fine textured, but it's coarse to walk on.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you're walking barefoot on it, it is a little, I don't want to say prickly, but it's very rigid.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's buffalo grasses are, we have more and more calls about that all the time, looking for seed. I actually have a friend who has a landscape business that sowed like a 5-acre lot with buffalo grass just last week.
Uh-huh.
So there are people that are kind of changing their aesthetic.
Well, I was thinking that you probably can't sell Zubrovka down there because you don't have a liquor license.
I don't have a liquor license.
But you might be able to serve it. I don't know.
We probably could get away with something like that.
Some of your customers come down there, loosen them up a little bit,
that's
buy
right.
a little more grass.
I like that idea. It amazes me that pretty much every plant that I come across has some connection to an intoxicating liquid. You know, I mean, really, I mean, who would have ever thought that you could take a little bit of Russian buffalo grass,
you kind of
mix it in with some vodka.
You wonder how that got started, you know, who discovered that and what were they thinking?
Exactly.
How much vodka had they had when they tried
that's
it?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, come on, Igor. Let's try a little buffalo grass in our vodka.
Yeah, and speaking of buffalo, of course, it's always kind of tickles me that you know, there are no buffalo in this country, or I don't think they're in Russia either.
No,
they're bison.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They are bison.
So that's just one of those plant misnamers, I guess.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Okay, let's see. It's 8:28, and you're listening to the Master Gardener Hour, the shortest hour in radio, with your host John Duke and my guest Jim Hansel from Ohio Rivergrass, and Amy Duke and Master Gardener Bibby Terry on WAIF Cincinnati, 88.3 FM. You can listen to the Master Gardener Hour here every Monday this summer from 8 to 9 o'clock in the morning. And the weather we've got has been pretty nice. Do these cool temperatures affect the grass very much, or just keeps them going a little longer?
Yeah, that's a great question. This year has been sort of an interesting year for us down at the nursery because I love to watch plants and how they react and respond to weather. We had a fairly cool spring, and how that affected us at the nursery was our grasses stayed dormant longer. It's the nighttime temperature that brings
them out. Not day length or anything.
Not really.
Okay.
You know, your intuition sort of tells you it's a day length.
Yeah.
But last spring it was a warm spring, and you know our grasses were probably 2 to 3 weeks ahead of where they were now.
Yeah.
Last year, because they had those early on evening warm temperatures. So if you've got ornamental grasses in your garden and we have a cool spring like we did this year, don't give up on them.
Yeah.
We just need to get that soil temperature up.
Uh-huh.
And we found at the nursery that it's the evening temperatures that influence the plant growth more than anything.
Okay.
So what we do to deal with that is we don't have heated greenhouses, but we've got greenhouses that we sort of just keep shut.
Uh-huh.
This spring we kept our greenhouses shut, and what that did is it helped those plant warm
break
up dormancy,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And start
growing. Well, you know, the daylilies were a little late this year.
Were they?
But probably the same thing. And I think the cicadas were a little late.
They were. It seems like when all that hurrah was going on about them, it seems like everyone kept saying, all the cicadas are coming, and they never seemed to come,
right.
And all of a sudden they were here.
Yeah.
But I think everything
was
a little
sense.
Bit later this year, just the cool temperature. Now, right now, what we're basking in the joy of lots of rain. Some of the native grasses don't like lots of rain, like some of the switch grasses, some of the big blue stems, even some of the Indian grasses. The more rain we get, just the straight native types can get a bit floppy. Mm. Now, what really likes this moisture that we've had this year are the pentacetums, or the fountain grasses, the maiden grasses, the miscanthus grasses, the carexes or sedges. Those plants are just thriving this year. It's been a great year for those plants.
Okay.
Lots of growth. Lots of really good growth.
So if you've got a little low spot in your yard that tends to stay wet, you've got just the right grass for it.
Yeah, exactly. You might want to stick with some of that, with some of the things that, that like a little more moisture. Well, what I find interesting, the more I get into studying and observing and just growing grasses, I find that as a general rule of thumb, and I hate general rules of thumb because you'll find five plants that will make a liar out of you every single time. But as a general rule of thumb, the native grasses tend to be much more drought tolerant. In fact, they'll thrive in droughty type situations. The exotic grasses, like the maiden grasses and the pentacetums, those grasses tend to perform better in more moist soils. So knowing that, you can sort of make sure you pick the right plant for that for your spot rather than trying to force the plant to fit in a spot it won't work.
Speaking of spots, what about light requirement?
That's an excellent question. That's something that we are really playing with. You know, when you pick up any book or whatever, any horticulture book, grass has got to be planted in full sun. Well, we have a couple of shady areas in the nursery. Some people might say the whole area where the nursery is shady, but we are trying some switch grasses and some other grasses in more of a shaded type environment just to see how far we can push these things. Because, you know, if I could find a grass that got 4 to 5 foot tall that would grow in the shade, I could retire on that one grass. Because that's what everyone that comes to the nursery wants. I mean, that's just where it is.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you need to really pay attention to how much shade is shade.
That's exactly right, and gets back to that.
Are you talking about shade where you don't get any, or are you talking about 2 hours a day or 4 hours a day?
That's a good question. Where we're trying some of these grasses, we're trying them in areas that get maybe 4 hours of direct sunlight, and then the rest would be, you know, dappled shade or even more dense shade. And what we're finding so far, we're kind of early into looking at this, but one of the things that we found so far is that the pentacetums, the fountain grasses, really benefit from afternoon shade. The foliage stays a little cleaner.
Okay.
The flowers don't get haggard out quite as fast. They don't flower as heavily as they would in the sun, but who cares? If I could have a grass-like plant that got 3-4 feet tall in the shade planted next to some maybe some sun-tolerant hosta or some other plants like that. What a great combination that would create.
Yeah.
So we're playing with that. Now, we do have, there are quite a few native plants, like the carexes and sedges, that would do well in the shade. I can think of, like the palm sedge and the seersucker sedge. Those are native sedges that do really well in the in the shade. The biggest grass that we promote for use in the shade is sea oats or wood oats.
Yeah.
Northern wood oats, Chasmanthium latifolium. That grass will get about 3.5 to 4 feet tall, and it does great in the shade. I've got some planted that get zero sunlight, direct sunlight. It's right up against the base of a 20-year-old river birch, and they're thriving.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay. Bibby? You're being mighty quiet today.
I'm letting Jim do all. I'm learning so much. This is just amazing. I'm going to go get some of those that will take no sun at all and stick them in the shade and see what happens.
Okay. You've got some...
Do you want me to read some of these
some
today?
Public service announcements to go?
I certainly do.
Okay, great.
And then one promo that Amy and I both like, so we'll read that one. But the Ohio Consumers Council is our first one, and it's a residential utility advocate serving as a resource for consumers who have questions and concerns or would like information about the services provided by their electric, natural gas, telephone, and water companies. If you'd like more information about the services that the Ohio Consumers Council offers, please visit their website at www.state.oh.us/cons. That's www.state.oh.us/cons. And then the next one is always an interesting one and one that is so, so necessary. This is a public service announcement about volunteer drivers. And the Cincinnati Area Senior Citizens Group needs drivers to volunteer 1 or 2 days a month. That's not a week, just 1 or 2 days a month to help area senior citizens get to the places they need to go. For more information on volunteering, please call 721-4330. That's 721-4330. Then this next one is just great. Tuesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m., if you'll tune in to WAIF, you'll get more than a fine gumbo of Louisiana music. This is Creole, Cajun, and New Orleans R&B, and it makes a wonderful and tasty dessert of ear candy. So join in and taste this low-calorie, high-energy buffet of America's original music. That's Crawfish Fiesta, and you can catch it only on WAIF 88.3. Thanks so much, John.
That's great. When does that come on again?
Now, wouldn't you know he'd do that to me? That's 8 to 10 p.m. on Tuesday evenings.
Okay. Maybe tomorrow we listen to some of that. Because I like that kind of music.
I do, too. Yeah.
Maybe you can mix in a little bit of that Russian
vodka.
That Russian vodka. And,
there we go.
That could be done.
That's right.
Okay. You said, Jim, that grasses are all wind-pollinated.
Correct.
And I know that's true, because mm-hmm. you said so.
Well,
but I know
good.
You.
Great.
But I know you're also interested in a much wider range of what's going on in the garden.
Oh, yeah.
And it's always been fascinating to me, and we've talked about this before, about the relationship between animals and plants from
yeah.
a pollination standpoint. And that book, Natural History of Pollination,
yes.
is that a Capone book too or somebody else? I don't remember.
I think he was co-author on that book, actually.
Was he? Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, cause
it's a great book. It just goes into all kind of detail about,
yeah.
and you could go out in the garden and watch some
yeah.
of this kind of stuff, you know.
Well, if you're a voyeur, I guess you can.
Yeah, well, it's sex in the garden.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
But what are some of your favorite things to look for in the garden?
I really like to watch butterflies in the garden. I'm beginning to learn about butterflies and their biology. And, for example, one of the things that I found out fairly recently was butterflies prefer flowers that are a little more flat
uh-huh.
because in their front or their back set of legs, you know, they're true
uh-huh.
insects, so they got three sets of legs. They've got
uh-huh.
a total of six legs. They actually have little devices or organisms in their feet that allow them to taste the plant.
Oh.
To know whether or not if there's nectar available to that insect to the butterfly.
Hmm.
So I love to go out in the garden at the nursery and just watch butterflies because they constantly go to those plants where they can actually light on them and walk on them, and that's
mm-hmm.
how they tell. The other thing that's amazing about the butterfly is it has a proboscis, which is a little
tongue.
Tongue basically, and it uncurls, and it just probes around and
uh-huh.
gathers nectar.
Yeah.
To me, that's amazing. And what happens when that butterfly walks on those flowers? There's a trade-off. The flower says, "Okay, you know, I need to get my genes somewhere else.
Right.
I need to get my pollen somewhere else. And you know, since plants are not mobile in the sense that, I think plants are pretty mobile, but they're not mobile in the sense that you and I are mobile. The trade-off is it produces nectar, and nectar tends to be a very nutrient-rich. I read something just last night that just blew my mind. I didn't realize this, but perennial plants will expend as much as 10 to 15% of all of their starch and sugar energy reserves on producing a single flower.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Annuals can use up to 40% of their energy to produce a flower, because an annual, as you well know...
And a lot of that is the nectar.
That's exactly right. Most of it
is
the nectar.
To attract the pollinator.
That is exactly right, because the pollen doesn't cost the plant that much to produce, and neither does the ovaries, but it's that nectar, that real rich nectar. So to watch a butterfly walk across those flowers, and then if you look real close, if it's... So pollen is a very unique... Pollen... I read once that pollen is like human fingerprints. It's very unique to that plant. So, for example, paleobotanists or botanists that look at fossil records have found fossilized pollen. And they've been able to identify that plant because the pollen has not changed from that plant
so
from
unique.
That time till now.
Wow.
So it's a very unique, it has a unique signature. And in fact... You know, pure taxonomy, you know, if you're a hardcore plant taxonomist, one of your major ways of identifying plants is by the sexual structure and function of the plant. I mean, now it's evolving and genetics are becoming more of taxonomist tools.
Well, the plant physiology, the whole thing, especially on the flower.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's the... I mean, if you're a pure taxonomist, that's what you look at. You don't look at anything else. You just look at flower structure and function. But back to the butterfly story, it's amazing to me when they get on a plant that's got, like, yellow pollen, you can see the little pollen grains on their feet. So then they flit over to another flower and walk on it, and guess what? They deposit that pollen onto the stigma or the female part of the flower that's sticky on top, and the pollen actually will pollinate and grow down into the ovary.
I know butterflies feed while resting.
That's correct.
On the flower, as opposed to moths.
Yes.
Which generally feed while they're hovering.
That's exactly right.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, moths have a much longer proboscis too. You know, moths have to feed strictly by scent.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously it's dark when most moths are nocturnal, whereas butterflies are diurnal. Like yucca, there's a great story. There's only one insect that pollinates yucca. I don't know if that's really great for us here in Cincinnati, but yucca are yucca. But out in the West, and even here in Cincinnati, there's only one insect that that pollinates yucca. And that's important to understand because, you know, if we disrupt our environment to the point to where we start killing off these pollinators by unmerited pesticide use or herbicide use, you run the risk of causing another plant to go extinct. I know, John, you have a fascination with evolutionary biology. I do, too. One of the things that I read a few weeks ago, sort of thinking about the show, was kind of the theory of coevolution. And I know you've read a lot about this, and it amazes me that as you trace the evolutionary history of plants, you also can trace the evolutionary history of insects,
right.
And they parallel.
Yeah, they do.
To me, that is fascinating.
And the thing to me that's really fascinating is the combinations of different physiology forms and shapes and methods and techniques. The variety is just amazing.
Well,
and it all works.
It all works. and you know, a neat story about that, talking about the shape of a flower. There's an orchid in Florida, and the way this orchid gets pollinated is its shape looks like a female wasp, and the male wasp thinks that he's found a lucky lady, and goes to mount the flower and actually pollinates it while he's trying to copulate with a flower, which to me
kind
is
a dirty trick, isn't it?
It is a dirty trick. Hey, anything it takes. You
yeah,
know?
Right. Plant sitting there laughing fooled you.
That's right. Walk goes away with nothing.
Oh, well, nature's wonderful.
That's right.
I'm not really changing the subject, but I do have a question.
Okay.
Have you found a grass, a perennial grass, that will prosper in a container and return the next year?
How big of a container are you talking about?
It could be a large.
A large. 36-inch container, mm-hmm. 24-inch container.
24, 36? Mm-hmm.
I think we're experimenting with that this year. We have put some switchgrasses in some containers. What I look for, if you're going to try to work a perennial grass into a container, there's a couple things you might want to look for.
Okay.
Obviously, cold hardiness is number one.
Right.
It's got, you know, because with the container being out of the ground, unless you're going to insulate the container somehow, which is not a fun.
No.
I mean, what's the point, you know?
Right.
Cold hardiness is going to be key, crucial.
Uh-huh.
So what we're doing is we're looking at the switchgrasses,
mm-hmm.
which are zone 4 hardy.
Okay.
We're also looking at the reed grasses, the Calamagrostis, like Carl Forrester.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the other reed grasses, Korean reed grass that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that we're going to try called Avalanche, which is a variegated Carl Forrester.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a new one. It's kind
That's
of a new
great.
One to the trade. It's been out a few years, but it's not as easy to find.
Is this the first year that you've tried this?
Yes.
So you won't really know till next year?
Yeah, I've talked to people, though, that have overwintered switchgrasses in containers
okay.
very successfully. So, you know, my recommendation, if you want to find a grass to do that, is to try the grasses that are, you know, zone 5,
uh-huh.
zone 4 hardy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing you can do is you can actually get the, if you can move the container,
uh-huh.
just get it in close proximity to your house or somewhere where it's somewhat protected.
Uh-huh.
The other thing you need to look out for is if you do put it like under an eaves or something like that, a lot
mm-hmm.
of people will just kind of forget about it and
not water.
I don't need any water. If you're going to do that, you need to water your grass about once every 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, because in the nursery, you know, we'll cut our grasses back in the greenhouses, and we will actually have to come in and water about once every 3 weeks.
Sure.
Because, you know, there's still biological activity going on in that plant
mm-hmm.
because
it's
a lot.
Down, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like mm-hmm. almost like being in suspended animation.
Yeah.
But there's still a need for water because a lot of times those roots will start growing first
mm-hmm.
before the tops start growing. Mm-hmm. And as those roots grow, they can capture water and nutrients and force the
right.
top to grow.
Okay. Good.
Real quick question.
Sure.
Jim, you just mentioned really quickly, if you're doing this, you said we cut our grasses back. That's one of the questions I've always had. I don't have a lot of grasses. I have a few in the front, but with an almost all-shade garden, I don't even try it yet. I'm going to let you do it first and then tell me if it works. But I do notice around the neighborhood, some people cut them all the way back. Some people leave them all winter long and then just let the new growth come up in it. What's the best way to handle grasses that way?
That's a good question. I'm going to give you sort of a twofold answer. I think part of it boils down to what you like. In the nursery, we cut all of our container plants back the first, second week of November. So we cut that stuff back early because if I leave the grasses tall in the greenhouses, they're hard to water. So from a production standpoint, that's when I cut them back. Now in the landscape or in the garden, we leave our grasses until March. We usually cut them back around the first, second week of March. I do know some people, like for example, Miscanthus or the maiden grass. The seeds will hold on that plant until probably about January, early January, and then they start dispersing. And I know a lot of people think that that's messy. They don't like the look of that. I personally don't care for it either. So there are some grasses that when they start dropping their seeds, if they're messy, go in and cut them back then. So like, you know, I had a customer a few months ago was mentioning that she loves the Miscanthus, the way they look all season, but she hates the way the seeds disperse. I said, just cut it off. I said, go
mm-hmm.
out right around Christmas time,
mm-hmm.
cut the plants off, put them in your compost pile, burn them, do whatever
mm-hmm.
you want to do with them. But that way you won't get the seed spread. Now, the switchgrasses, I find, are best to leave up until March because they stay very upright and they provide
mm-hmm.
a lot of winter structure.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. You mentioned a good point. If you're picking grasses for your garden, you want to find some things that are going to have winter interest. Because, you know, when you cut these things back in March, It's going to be mid-May before you start to see any size to the plant. So you're going to have April and maybe half to three-quarters of May before you really have any interest. So in my mind, it's like I want to extend that season as long as I can. I think that's the aversion of some people that have to using grasses is the fact that you have to cut them back in the spring. But, gosh, what a long season of interest.
Yeah, most plants have an ugly period. I mean, look at daffodils and tulips and all those. I mean,
that's true.
All go through the daylilies.
Yes. It is. It's just part of gardening. And I think the challenge for us as gardeners is to figure out how you can work with that by using other plants to change the focal points in our gardens.
Mm-hmm.
How
far do you cut them back? That's the other million-dollar question. I like to cut my grasses back to about 8 to 10 inches. It's a little bit taller than what a lot of people will cut them back. And the reason that I do that, the way the biology of grasses is such that the crown is where all the bud, where all the stems are, the rhizomes. And that's where the buds and things reside. And there are some grasses, like for example, last year when we cut the grasses back, we cut a few of the grasses back a little too far and actually damaged the crown.
Oh.
And, you know, what happened is half the plant was dead and the half was alive on the other side. So you got to kind of watch how far you cut. I think by cutting down to 8 inches, it's aesthetically appealing enough that it looks okay in the garden, but it protects that crown.
I had heard from somewhere that they should be cut back at least before they start growing, before you see them. Is that...
Yeah, you don't have...
And with March, that would take care of that.
You don't have to cut them back before they're growing. I mean, in production, you all might find it interesting. We shear our grasses back maybe one or two times a season during the growing period. So, like, I've got some maiden grass or miscanthus that we just cut back 4 weeks ago. And, you know, we do that because we want to maintain a real vigorous growing plant in a pot.
Yeah. Grasses like to be cut.
They do. I mean, think
really?
Of your turf. I mean, your turf is a grass, just like an ornamental grass is a grass. So if you've got an ornamental grass that you planted 5 years ago and you're like, oh, my God, why did I do this? It's too big. What you can do is go out in mid-May and just give it a shear.
Yeah.
Cut it back by half.
Yeah.
Or cut it down to 12 inches.
Even a lot of woody plants like to be rejuvenated.
That's exactly right. Like by Burnham.
By Burnham, red twig dogwood.
Exactly.
Even Daphne.
Yeah, absolutely.
Likes that.
But you can shear your grasses back, and what that does is it reduces the height at which they'll flower. So if you've got a grass that you planted, but you really like where it is, if you can tolerate about 3 weeks of it looking cut back, which I don't think is too bad, you can do that.
Is it too late in the season to cut one now?
It's getting too late now because we're getting into the flowering period. So I think if you're going to cut your grasses back, I recommend, you know, the warm season grasses, I recommend cutting back, you know, by mid-May at the latest.
Okay. I wanted to mention just one thing. I don't know whether you're familiar with marker-assisted breeding.
No.
This kind of gets into the whole business of genetically modified crops. Which a lot of people are worried about and everything.
Yeah.
But you know, when you think about it, if you understand the DNA, if you have that layout and you know what's what, and you go in and you genetically modify something, that's really not a whole lot different than hybridizing, except hybridizing is random.
Yeah.
Now what they're doing with a lot of the cereals now, wheat and corn even, is called marker-assisted breeding. And what they do is they just hybridize it, and then because they know the DNA and what pieces of the DNA they want to keep, they look at the DNA analysis of the plant and select based on the DNA. And so it's just a selection process called marker-assisted selection, and it's not really genetically modified, and it gets around all the regulations and stuff that they have to do, but it ends up with the same kind of result.
Yeah, see that I find that intriguing. I think that's good to do. I get a little concerned when people actually go in and, you know, put fish genes in carrots or whatever. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they're doing.
Yeah.
The reason being is that it's such a rapid change.
Right.
You know, what does it do to the genetics
Yeah, but I thought that was pretty clever.
That is very clever.
And
Say it again. What's it called?
It's called marker-assisted breeding.
Marker-assisted breeding.
And
okay.
It's just using the DNA marker that you're looking for.
Yeah.
To do the selection.
To do the selection. That's that's fascinating.
And it saves time and,
oh, yeah,
and all the regulatory stuff you go through with genetically modified foods, especially. Do they hybridize grasses?
It's sort of a happenstance.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, I've talked to some growers and things around the country, and a lot of times what will happen is grasses have to be vegetatively propagated,
right,
because they are wind pollinated, so you've got really don't have any controls over how they pollinate.
Right.
So what will happen is, you know, growers, the grower that I work with in North Carolina, for example, lines his plants out in a field and actually grows them for maybe 2-3 seasons and then harvests and makes plants out of that. So what will happen is something will happen within that field, and there'll be a plant that's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. So they'll select.
And they'll select
bit.
That. Yeah. And, you know, if you decide to come down to the garden, I can show you in the garden some of these same type plants, because we've got some, too, that we're looking at.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. Well, unfortunately, we're getting a little low on time.
That definitely was the shortest hour, on the radio. Wow.
And I was going to mention a few upcoming events. I think I'll skip that today in the interest of time and get into it. Well, maybe I won't. Let's see, because the Boone County Fair is starting today, actually. It's running this week. And Boone County has an awful lot of free classes, education classes. I don't know anywhere around town that offers as many classes as they do. It's you can find out about that by calling 859-586-6101. And the next Master Gardener class is going to be starting in September. I'll talk more about that next week. And, okay, I guess it's time to start the music and wind things up. Do you have any last thoughts, Jim?
No, just thank you so much. It's been,
well, it's been great.
Always great talking with you about gardening.
Well, it's great,
and teasing the mind a little bit. It's always fun.
And I hope we had a lot of listeners. And thank you, Bibby and Amy, for coming.
Welcome.
Okay. Start the music here. WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. My theme music for the show was Coconuts on the CD Nature's Bounty by Mystical Moods. This has been the Master Gardener Hour with John Duke. You can listen to the Master Gardener Hour every Monday morning this summer from 8 to 9 a.m. on WAIF Cincinnati 88.3 FM. All we ask is 1 hour a week. We welcome your comments and suggestions, so please send a note to WAIF 1434 East McMillan Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45206, in care of the Master Gardener Hour. I'll be back next Monday. My guest will be Joe Boggs from Hamilton County Extension. And I don't know what we're going to talk about, but Joe's always full of good information. It's only 167 hours from now, so make them count. And stay tuned for One Voice. And take care of yourself. Your garden needs you. And thanks for listening.